This is Philip Adams from LNL here. I know you're about to listen to an RN podcast, but if you've got time, why not also download LNL, one of the most long-running and popular programs on the network and indeed the entire universe.
And hello from me, Andrew West. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. There was an interesting image over the weekend of the new Pope washing the feet of 12 young offenders at a juvenile detention centre in Rome. Not only were two of them women, a breach of church practice that enraged many conservatives, two were also Muslims. In his Good Friday message, Pope Francis also referred to our Muslim brothers. Now, our guest today says that he too writes in the spirit of Christian-Muslim friendship, but his latest book is sure to provoke. Rupert Short is religion editor at the Times Literary Supplement in London and the biographer of a Pope and an Archbishop of Canterbury. His latest book is called Christianophobia, A Faith Under Attack. Now, you might recall that last year we spoke at length with philosopher Martha Nussbaum about her book, which focused on what she called Islamophobia. Well, in this interview, Rupert Short argues that across the Middle East, North Africa and Asia, Christians are the victims of discrimination and violence.
There was a kind of apple on the head moment for me when I saw the suicide video of Muhammad Sadiq Khan. He was a Yorkshire-born British Muslim and the ringleader of the 7/7 bombers in London. He said, "We are doing this because Muslims are getting killed." And I thought to myself, well, hold on a moment. What were you doing when the greatest mass murderer of Muslims of modern times, Saddam Hussein, was butchering away? What about the fact that an enormous proportion of violence suffered by Muslims is inflicted by fellow Muslims? But above all, look beyond Iraq and Afghanistan and on a time frame going back well before 9/11, and you can see that Christians get a far worse deal from Muslims than vice versa. It's just that they don't bang drums about it. I mean, young Christians in the West do not become radicalized, and persecuted Christians on the ground rarely respond with terrorist violence. And I think that the lie, if you like, at the heart of the Al-Qaeda narrative, which has been swallowed not only by a lot of Muslims, but also by self-lacerating liberals in the West, is that Muslims are greater targets than anybody else. The truth is there's an awful lot of persecution all over the shop, and Christians are probably persecuted in greater numbers than any other faith.
Well, you illustrate that persecution with just a litany of incidents. I wonder though, Rupert, whether a large part of this persecution is specific anti-Christian prejudice, or could it be a general anti-Western sentiment that's been whipped up, especially in the last 10 years, by wars that have been fought on Muslim soil?
Yes, I think that's a perfectly valid point. I wouldn't deny that. I was against the Iraq war myself. But we need to remember that Christianity isn't really a Western religion. It's a Southern and an Eastern and a Middle Eastern faith. And I think the idea that Christianity is a Western import rather than an export from the Middle East is used, manipulated by people who have malign agendas of their own.
Yes, although people like Pope Benedict the 16th, he's one of those who's talked about the uniquely Christian heritage of Europe. So some Christian leaders have associated the West with Christianity, haven't they?
They have indeed. I mean, you're right to suggest that there is a social and political element to a lot of what's wrongly interpreted as faith-based strife. Very often, I think Christians can be the heralds of more open societies. They can be associated with access to education for girls and greater transparency, greater democracy, and Christians can be resented for that reason as well.
On page 8 of your introduction, you quote Timothy Shah and Monica Toft, who are American sociologists, and they say that, quote, God is winning in global politics, and modernization, democratization, and globalization have only made him stronger. So what happened to the conventional wisdom that globalization enthusiasts had, that these trends were supposed to make people more secular and more liberal?
Oh, it's an old chestnut, isn't it? Imagining that we are all heading towards the sunlit uplands of a godless future. From where I'm sitting, there has been an assumption that the rest of the world is playing catch-up and that rates of religious observance will fall naturally as people become more scientifically literate, as people become more educated generally. In fact, the truth is the opposite of that, really. The situation in Western Europe is, if anything, the exception. Secularization has gone into reverse in many parts of the world. And although in certain societies like India and Turkey, for example, the charisma of the founding fathers with quite strongly secularist visions lasted for a while, as their influence has faded, then the place of faith, the importance of faith, has become clearer and clearer.
You're listening to the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Andrew West. I'm speaking with Rupert Short. He's religion editor at the Times Literary Supplement and the author of Christianophobia, A Faith Under Attack, published by Random House. Well, Rupert, we referred to this democratization process. I want to look first at Egypt, because this is where the Arab and the Muslim world is now kind of looking at a laboratory of the Arab Spring. What has the Arab Spring and the democratic elections that it did bring to Egypt, what has that meant for Egypt's minority Christian population?
I think things have been very difficult, really. They were difficult under Mubarak. It's worth bearing in mind that over the past 30 years, about 600,000 Christians have either left Egypt or been persecuted in some way, and in some cases involving severe injury and death. But the overwhelming majority have simply up sticks because life was being made so difficult for them. But they view the future with great trepidation, because one form of dictatorship may be being replaced by another.
And of course, Christianity predates Islam in Egypt. I mean, the Coptic community there, Coptic, I think, is the Greek word for Egyptian. So we're talking really here about one of the indigenous religions of Egypt.
Absolutely. The Christian roots of Egypt are very, very deep. I should say, I would hate people to think that I take an uncritical attitude to my own faith. It's precisely because I am a Christian that I'm aware of the dysfunctionality of Christians both now and in the past. And it's sobering to think that many Christians in Egypt welcome the prospect of Muslim rule during the latter stages of the first millennium, when Christians were quarrelling among themselves so much. Having said that, Christians went on to become second-class citizens.
Yes, you do point out that the migration pattern of Coptic Christians out of Egypt is first of all regional, going to other places in the Middle East, and then they end up in places like the United States, Canada, the UK and Australia. But why do you think it's important to keep this presence of Christians in Egypt and the broader Middle East?
Well, Christianity is an export from the Middle East. I think it's absolutely heartbreaking to see it declining so steeply in its biblical heartlands. Secondly, I think that a strong religious ecology is a good thing by definition. I think it's great when people of different faiths can live side by side with one another in tolerance. I should also stress that I'm perfectly aware and say a number of times in my book that when people were being burnt at the stake in Europe several centuries ago, Christians were living peacefully in the Ottoman Empire and other Muslim societies, and Christians have become a lot more self-critical and tolerant over the past century or so, and particularly over the past 50 years. But things weren't ever thus, and a lot of the turmoil in the Middle East at the moment has political roots, and I wouldn't want to be particularly hard on Islam as such. If you like, the Middle East is going through its equivalent of the 1930s at the moment politically.
Well, no, you're not unduly hard on Islam itself. I mean, I think it's more a politicised and radicalised form of Islam that has you worried. Let's look at Iraq, because Christians were also one of the earliest populations there. Now, how has the liberation, in inverted commas, by the forces of the Christian West played out for the Christian population in Iraq? I'm obviously referring to the Second Iraq War.
Yes, that's been catastrophic. Needless to say, I'd just like to, as a bit of a qualification to what you've just said, point out that it's a bit of a mistake to associate the Western forces with Christianity. And I think that is done because the Muslim world has much less of a sense of a separation between church and state. So the idea is that an army coming from a Western country must somehow be an agent of Christianity. Just for the record, let me point out that every single major historic church in the region, and the Roman Catholic Church, obviously representing by far the largest body of Christians in the world, and the Anglican Communion, the leaders of all these bodies were vehemently against the Iraq War. And the poor old Christians in Iraq, needless to say, were very opposed to the policies of George Bush. And they've suffered grievously.
You do point out, as you say, that Pope John Paul II spoke out against the Iraq War. True enough. I'm thinking of some of those American generals, though, one or two who were quoted as telling their troops that this was part of, I think some of them even used the word crusade.
Yes.
There have been huge movements of Christians out of Iraq since 1990, I think. So what sort of numbers are we talking about here, Rupert?
In 1990... there were between 1.2 and 1.4 million Christians in the country. By the time of the Second Gulf War in 2003, this figure had fallen by about 500,000. Today, fewer than 200,000 remain. So in other words, life wasn't all rosy under Saddam Hussein either. Many, many Christian villages and other communities were destroyed by him, whittled away. But things have got very, very much worse over the past decade.
But to what extent, though, did that Christian population receive some form of protection from Saddam Hussein's dictatorship? Because it does pose the same, I guess, ethical dilemma as you've got in Syria, because religious minorities there have had to rely on a pretty ruthless dictatorship for their protection as well.
Yes, it's a question of the devil you know, really. I wouldn't have thought that most Christians in a country like Syria were under any illusions about the brutality of the regime there. They're simply fearful about how the situation might become even worse if the Assad regime were to be overthrown, and I think the same applied in Iraq.
And I think you point out that the constitution of the new liberated, in inverted commas, Iraq actually included Islam as a central feature for the first time.
Yes, I think the constitution under Saddam Hussein said that Iraq was officially a Muslim country as well, despite his secularist credentials. There's an idea that he made life easier for Christians. It's well known that Tariq Aziz, the former foreign minister, was a Christian. But as I've indicated, life wasn't all that easy. There were dozens of Christian villages in the north of the country that were destroyed during the 60s and 70s, and Christians really had to keep their heads down.
Now, neighbouring Iran is a very interesting case because its constitution not only recognises other faiths, Christians, Jews, Zoroastrians, it also gives them seats in parliament. But you argue this is illusory because there's really a kind of religious apartheid going on in Iran. What's that all about?
That's true. My book deals with discrimination as well as persecution. It's very important to be aware of the difference. Christians are second-class citizens in many Muslim-majority societies in the Middle East and elsewhere. In Iran, we're talking about active persecution in some quarters, but also lots of laws that shackle Christians. There are lots of things that they can't do and jobs that they can't have. The real worry, I think, that the powers that be in Iran feel is that, particularly in relation to Protestant groups, that there's a more benign kind of Christianity which is connected with the historic churches, which go back to the first millennium and indeed predate Islam in Persia as well. And then there are Protestant missionaries who are associated much more with a Western outlook as well as a strong biblical faith.
And they're paranoid, the Iranian government, about conversions from Islam to Christianity, aren't they?
Yes, this is a very big problem in the Muslim world as a whole. There is a widespread notion abroad that you can convert to any faith you like as long as it's to Islam. The idea that you might convert away from Islam is deeply troubling to the Muslim conscience in many parts of the world and indeed seen as absolutely intolerable.
How much of that, Rupert, is because they argue that Islam is the final revelation for the monotheistic religions, and how could you possibly go back?
Absolutely, that's the theological kernel. If you have the perfect revelation, as it were, in Islam, then there shouldn't be any going back. Islam, I would say, generalising very broadly, has never been as bad as Christianity at its worst and never been as good as Christianity at its best. It's worth bearing in mind that there have never been pogroms or anything like the Holocaust, for instance, in the Muslim world. Let's not forget that 70 or 100 years ago, of course, it was Christian heartlands that formed the epicentre of unparalleled violence in the world. On the other hand, as I've indicated, the Christian world now has become a great deal more tolerant and self-critical. The Muslim world occupies, if you like, a sort of intermediate position.
Well, that's a very good point. You're listening to the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Andrew West. I'm speaking with Rupert Short. He's religion editor at the Times Literary Supplement and the author of Christianophobia, A Faith Under Attack, published by Random House. I want to look at two countries that are held up often, if you like, as poster boys for modern Islamic democracies. One is Turkey, and in our region, Indonesia. Contemporary Turkey seems to be marrying kind of two strands of its history. You've got the Islam of the Ottoman Empire and the nationalism of the Ataturk years. And that plays out, doesn't it? Because if you're not a Muslim, if you're a Christian or a Jew, you're seen to be loyal to another state. Your nationalism is under question, isn't it?
Very much so. I mean, the Orthodox Church has its wings clipped very, very severely. Christian schools and other foundations are controlled. Strictly, there need to be Muslim members of staff. The patriarch of the Greek Orthodox Church, the ecumenical patriarch, as he's known, although he's not allowed to use that title in public, but he is effectively the senior Orthodox leader in the world. He is subject to very tight restrictions and he has to be a Turkish citizen. And that means that the pool from which they can fish for a new leader is very small because there are now only a few thousand members of his flock left. And there are lots of sinister things going on in Turkey. There's William Dalrymple in his book From the Holy Mountain, in which he traced the journey of a monk from Mount Athos around the perimeter of the Eastern Roman Empire. He travelled through southern Turkey in the early 90s and then later in the late 90s, and he found that Christian archaeological remains had been systematically removed. That's one piece of evidence that you could cite. I've become friendly with monks at the monastery of Mor Gabriel. It's one of the oldest monasteries on earth. It's on the border between Turkey and Iraq. It was founded in the 4th century. And they've been knocked around from pillar to post, suspected both by the Turkish authorities of being fifth columnists for the Kurds, and suspected by the Kurds of being supporters of the Turkish government, and their land has been confiscated, and they've just faced one depredation after another.
Let's skip quickly down to Indonesia, because it's a country that's of great interest to Australia. Now, this is another country where it looks, quote, good on paper. 12% of Indonesia's population is Christian. You'd assume that was a sizable enough minority to have some political power. But tell me about the creeping influence. Well, I'm not sure if it's a creeping influence. It could be a rampaging influence of the Saudi government and Wahhabist Islam in Indonesia.
I think that's the trouble. Just imagine if we were to transpose this conversation into a Christian key. Imagine that there was a country in the world that was dominated by extremely vehement Protestant fundamentalists who wanted to, let's say, introduce the Ten Commandments into public law. Imagine then that one of the largest supplies of oil on earth was discovered where these people were living, so that they suddenly became enormously rich and influential. That's the trouble with the export of Salafism from Saudi Arabia. Islam has been a much more heterogeneous phenomenon in the past, and the tragedy is that you have these extremists and hotheads gaining influence in Indonesia, and it's making life very, very difficult for Christians.
And Australia is especially interested in Indonesia. As I said, it's our closest neighbour to the north, and obviously it's in the interests of Australia to want stability. But in your research, you detect a fear, I think, that Indonesia could end up fracturing along religious lines, a bit like in the Sudan.
Yes, there is that worry. One desperately hopes not. I was very shocked by the extent of the attacks on Christian congregations. There's a feeling that in a given community, it's somehow greedy or rapacious for there to be more than one Christian place of worship. If there's one mosque, there's an idea that there should only be one church. What some Muslims find hard to get their heads around is the idea that you will have a Catholic church and then maybe various strains of Protestantism. And because there's something very freewheeling, very entrepreneurial about, for example, the rise of Pentecostalism, it's no part of my case to say that Christians are always completely guiltless. And if missionaries are marching into Muslim areas and singing hymns very loudly or proselytizing in an insensitive way, then it's understandable that people should feel threatened.
Let's finish by coming back to where we began, and that's the Middle East, but specifically to the birthplace of Christianity, which is the Holy Land or Israel-Palestine. You point to a dramatic slide in the number of Christians in Israel-Palestine, and you do point to the role of radical Islam in driving away a lot of Christians. But you also argue the Israeli government is partly responsible. How is that?
Yes, I think the poor Christians are caught in the middle, really. There's a newly militant Islamist surge on the Palestinian side. Palestinian nationalism, incidentally, was more of a secular movement to start with, and there are a lot of Christians involved with its inception. It's acquired more of a religious tinge, sadly, over the past couple of decades. But I don't think the Israeli authorities can be absolved of chauvinism either. The Greek Orthodox monk who was the custodian of Jacob's Well at Nablus, he was killed by Jewish settlers some years ago, and Christian Arabs are marginalised in all sorts of respects.
Wouldn't the Israelis argue, though, that some Christian leaders have kind of brought this on themselves in that they've allowed themselves to be politicised as part of the Palestinian national struggle? Because there were quite a few Christians who were very much spokespeople for Palestinian nationalism, weren't there?
Yes, although you could argue on the contrary that the chief harm done by Christians has been in support of a very particular understanding of Zionism. Christians are really divided in the Holy Land. There are the indigenous Christians and the adherents of the historic churches, who I think on the whole take an admirably even-handed stance. Then there are Protestant fundamentalists, mainly from America, who are, if you like, in a sort of marriage of convenience with Israeli Zionists. It's an odd situation because the Christian fundamentalists, according to their interpretation of Revelation, believe that Armageddon will come before the conversion of the Jews, which of course is not the Jewish understanding, but for the sake of present more immediate goals, they can forge alliances with each other. The main criticism I have of the Israeli government is the land grab. I mean, the way that Arab East Jerusalem is being systematically swallowed up and property is being, including church property, is being taken over, so that what was formerly a mixed religious ecology is becoming more homogenised. I feel very sad about that.
Well, on that point, you have a beautiful, very telling quote from Father Yazid Saeed, who's an Israeli citizen, a Palestinian Arab. He's also an Anglican priest. He says, looking at the Holy Land today, one sees a very dim picture of religious coexistence. Judaism does not come across as the religion of faith and promise and witness, but that of a settler land grab. He then says the stress on Christian nationalism hasn't been successful, and that Islamic fanaticism has come in to fill the gap. So, you know, this is another force which is tearing the Christian community away from its historic roots.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that very much. It's a melancholy picture.
Well, Rupert Short, religion editor at the Times Literary Supplement and author of Christianophobia, A Faith Under Attack, thank you for being on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you.
And you can download or podcast that provocative interview from the Religion and Ethics Report homepage at the RN website. Now, just before we go, as you probably heard, the Royal Commission into the Abuse of Children by Institutions, including the churches, formally opened today. But the chairman, Justice Peter McClellan, said that public hearings won't begin probably until October. Nonetheless, we'll try to look at that commission and the parallel inquiry in New South Wales in the coming weeks. You can leave a comment. You can follow us on Twitter at ABC Religion. Thanks to our producer, Noel Debian, and this week to technical producer, Luke Purse. That is the program for this week. Next, it's Drive with Waleed Ali. Hello, Waleed.
Hey, Andrew. How are you going?
Very well.
The Queen got a pay rise. Did you hear about this?
She needed one, I'm sure.
I didn't even know she had a salary. You see, I'd grown up with that wonderful classic film, King Ralph, that you might remember, John Goodman was in, where he discovered he was part of royalty. And one of the lines that stuck in my memory from that was that when he asked what the salary was, he was very disappointed to hear that he didn't have any because he didn't need any. His needs were just taken care of. How much? Why would the Queen get paid in the first place?
The real thing is, I'm not sure that she's going to carry a Visa card with her.
That's
so we
true.
Don't have to worry about lavish spending on the platinum.
But isn't the point that she can spend lavishly now? I just don't understand. Seriously, if you are a monarch, do you need any plastic? When do you spend money?
I think, as I say, I think it's all laid out for you. The same goes with US presidents and the odd New South Wales premier, I believe.
Yes, although that's a different story slightly. But I just wonder, I mean, it seems to me there should be no salary at all. I can't understand it. And it's a big raise. We're talking £5 million, which is about 7.2 million Australian dollars. What does she spend it on and why does she get it? That's one of the things. It's a bee in my bonnet at the moment, Andrew. So I'm going to try to get to the bottom of that, as well as much of the day's news on RN Drive after the news.